Good morning, Greg Hughes here. Thank you very much for listening to this repeat of the 9 till noon show. Don't forget, you can still get involved in the conversation. Text or WhatsApp 086 60 25000 or email comments at highlandradio.com.
Okay, you're welcome back to the 9 till noon show. Good morning if you're just joining us. Some of your comments here following the first hour of the show. A caller says, I don't see the point protesting outside Letterkenny Hospital. People should be protesting in Dublin, not Letterkenny. It's the doctors or hospital's fault. It's the government's. Go build a new hospital. As I said before, protest outside of Dublin is useless, believes another listener. Hi, Greg. Wouldn't go to a protest where politicians are involved because they are the ones in power, so should be doing something about hospitals, as this is why they were elected. Hi, Greg. Roads were still icy on Saturday. People who are mostly affected by hospital overcrowding are mostly, but not all, old or sick-minded. Someone young or old. Many have no transport. There's very poor public transport in our county. Well done, Mary T, and all who turned up at the rally. Agree with Mary T. Sweeney about a minor injury clinic. It's disgraceful that with about a dozen of these essential medical centres spread around the country, the nearest to Donegal is Monaghan and Roscommon, another example of a Dublin-based Donegal divide. Hi, Greg. A bit of irony. Politicians organising protests about hospitals. And is it not that long ago Joe McHugh trying to close down all the community hospitals in Donegal? I don't think that's a fair assessment of Joe McHugh's role in that, but I understand where you're coming from. Greg, you got this wrong. Nothing to do with politics. All these years at hospital protest, Letterkenny residents won't come out, period. Okay, just throwing out some possibilities there. But as I say, I was actually trying to be positive as to why I still thought it would be a good crowd. But obviously, I think that might have been picked up the wrong way. Hi, Greg. Could you raise the issue, the serious issue over the weekend that happened in the Mercy Hospital in Cork while a sick, helpless man was attacked and murdered while in the care of the health service? Surely this merits the conversation around extra capacity of security services in all hospitals. It beggars belief that only one security officer is employed during the day and two at night, whilst in Sligo, it has 34 on day and night. Surely this is a case of mismanagement and powers within. Are you saying there's 34 security at Sligo University Hospital and much less at LUH? I'm not sure. We can put an inquiry in to find out what the level of security at the various hospitals are with the HSC. I can't wait for the Irish programme because I'm learning. It is for beginners because I have very little of it. Do they have books on it? Well, we'll find out information on that for you. Shouldn't all attacks on people carry the same sentence rather than a special law for the Gardaí? But everybody, I suppose, is not charged with enforcing the law. Gardaí are. I suppose everyone's not charged with making people better. Doctors and nurses are. I think the argument being that because of their particular role, that they perhaps require more attention. I mean, if we don't do something, there's going to be very few guards and less and less people working in the health service. Why would you take on a job that you can be assaulted on, and because you're dealing particularly often with people that we're not always dealing with in general society? I can see the strong argument for special treatment for the emergency services. But if you don't, tell us a wee bit more why you don't. When our protectors are selling drugs and giving info to criminals, it's no wonder there's so much oversight. I'm a public servant. I got physically assaulted during my duties by a member of the Garda, and there were obviously nothing done, even though I had two witnesses. I think give respect, get respect. Another, many people see the Garda as a government enforcer rather than a protector of the people, which is the point I was trying to make to the sergeant there. Has that sort of led to a different attitude towards the Gardaí, and I think maybe even damaging the recruitment process? I personally wouldn't have asked the question if I didn't suspect it was a factor. I'm not saying it's justified. I'm just suspecting it to have something to do with it. Most hatred for Gardaí come from the homes. Parents need to think about how they speak about our protection services. No respect for Gardaí. Unreal. What happened to Garda in Dublin this weekend, says a caller. And another one from Councillor Michael McClafferty. Renaming and rebranding is not helping at the moment with the health service. Whatever the model was before with the North Western Health Board, it needs to be brought back. They also need to bring back matrons on the walls, on the wards, so that people take responsibility. Also, no sign of the renovation that's meant to take place in Falkara since before COVID. No sign as if it will ever be done. A few points there. Right, okay, we're going to be speaking to the chief executive of the parole board shortly. to find out a little bit more information about their role. There's currently an ad campaign running on Highland about the role of the parole board and the role they play. It's an independent statutory body that considers applications for parole from prisoners serving life sentences once the prisoners concerned have served at least 12 years of their sentence. Is that correct? Well, anyway, I'll find more out about that now in saying good morning to Corinne DeBush, who's chief executive of the Parole Board. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg.
Right, OK. So what is the purpose of the ads at the moment? What information are you trying to get out there? What are you trying to inform people of?
Well, what we're doing is we've an ad campaign running across local and national media. And I suppose what we're really trying to do is to get the message to victims of serious crimes. So these are serious crimes that resulted in a life sentence, that they, as victims, now have a right to a voice within the parole process, that they can engage with us, that they can make a submission about the parole application if and when one is coming up, and that we will help and steer them through that process. And we're very aware that for some it can be it's not the easiest process to go through. It can bring up a lot of issues. So we will work with people in terms of making that submission around the parole application. And we do want to hear from them as well. It's important that people realise and recognise that they do.
Right. So how does it work at the moment? So someone's in prison. How do they be considered for parole? How is it decided? Does the person in question address a parole board? I'm kind of thinking of what people might have seen on the TV versus what actually is the reality. So before we talk about how the victims of crime can get involved and what supports there are there for them, so talk to me about how the parole process works.
Well, you're right, Greg. It's actually quite different to what we might assume from having seen it on television. So in Ireland, we have the Parole Act from 2019, and that sets out the process. But the short version of it is when there are eligible applicants, so those in prison who've been sentenced to a life sentence, who have served at least 10 and a half years, we will then ask them if they want to apply. When they're sending in their application, so if they confirm to us that they do want to apply, we will then, if we have their contact details, also contact the victims or the victim's family in that particular case. While the parole applicant is getting their application in and we are gathering all the information from the prison service and the other services that work with them, we'll also be linking in with those victims and asking them if they want to make a submission. Those victims can make their submission either in person, meeting with two parole board members, or in writing. And it's important that they know that that submission forms part of what we call the dossier, all of that information we've gathered that is shared with the parole applicant.
All right. And from the parole board's perspective, how do you approach this? Is it with a blank canvas? In other words, this person is eligible to be considered for parole, you know, maybe yes or maybe no. Or is it sort of loaded slightly towards that, you know, the person may be satisfactorily rehabilitated at the moment, and now in their interest, it's good to get them back into society. So in other words, what is the leaning of the system?
Well, again, it's a fresh application, and it's set out then in the legislation. We can't make a parole order unless we think that the parole applicant would not, if they were to be released, pose what the legislation terms an undue risk.
But my point is, are you being encouraged to give these people parole, or do you start a position of where you'd need to be discouraged to give them parole?
Well, it's set out. There's tests set out within the legislation and people have to meet those. So it sets out what we consider. And then within that, then that a parole order can be made where somebody wouldn't pose an undue risk, where they have been rehabilitated, and where it's appropriate in all circumstances that they would be released. Mm. And I suppose the thing that we would emphasise with victims, while an applicant can apply for parole, it doesn't necessarily mean that they will get parole.
Yep.
And that's something that it's important that people bear in mind. At times they will, and at other times they won't. It's very much down to whether or not that applicant would pose an undue risk, whether they've been rehabilitated, and whether it is appropriate that they would be released. Mm.
Right. So what weight is given to the submissions from the victims or the families of a victim, for example? I mean, they might come in if someone was murdered, for example, or raped, they might come in and make an argument that you couldn't see any justification for any because they've had to live with this and will have to live with it in perpetuity. So, a bit obviously, you can't always presumably go with the victim even after they've engaged with the board. So, how is that weighted? The fact that these people may want the person to stay in prison for their full sentence over the rest of their lives, how is it weighted against good behaviour in prison or taking some courses to try and change sort of their attitudes or behaviour?
Again, I suppose the victim submission is one piece of information that forms the round of information that the parole board would have. So there's a lot more that would come through then. And a lot of victims, you're right, will say that this person should never be released. And others will say, we know they will be released at some stage and we don't want to see them in our hometown or in our home village. And it's those types of conditions as well that we do want to hear from victims in terms of if they feel that there are particular conditions that should be attached to a parole order. But again, every victim will come with a different perspective, and the board are very aware of that. And they're talking very much from their own individual experience as well. So again, that information forms part of the wider dossier and the wider round of information that the board would consider. And it does keep coming back to that piece of legislation. And it's actually, if anyone does want to look at it, it's a very accessibly written piece of legislation that sets out what we need to consider and what we can take into account.
Right. So in terms of the supports given to victims, there is the parole board. You've already outlined some of it, so we might go through that because it's not a case of, do you want to make a submission and then you have to turn up and go into some room in Dublin and face the people might believe that to be the case. Mm-hmm. Clearly, sure. It's very much not the case. So just outline, after someone's been invited to make a submission to the parole board, how are they supported in making that submission, whether there has to be a legal element to the support or what have you. Just maybe talk us through that, Corinne, please.
Okay. Well, we will talk to the victim and I suppose talk them through the process so then they can make an informed decision about whether or not they want to make a submission. If they do want to make a submission, the next stage of that is whether or not they want legal aid during the process. So we can provide a solicitor to talk them through the process and to help them through the process. Many victims find this useful and many others will prefer to do it themselves. So again, it's very much whatever suits that individual family member and how they would prefer to do it. If they're making a submission in person, what would happen is two members of the parole board will go to meet with them, along with some staff from the parole board who will make a note of that meeting. Throughout that meeting, they can have their solicitor with them. They never meet the perpetrator during this parole process. And that's important because one of the things that we found from victims who have engaged with us is they're concerned that they don't want to meet the perpetrator. The way our process works, the victim doesn't meet with the perpetrator during the parole process. They will meet with board members and they will then talk through the impact of the offence, the impact it's had on their lives, and anything they want to say to us. We are there to listen to them about their experience and what they want to tell us about this application. And then it's taken back to the full parole board who will make a decision on that parole application in time.
The person up for parole, do they get access to these submissions?
I beg your pardon, Greg?
The person who is applying for parole, do they get access to these submissions in advance of a decision?
They do. And that's an important point for victims to be aware that their submission will be shared with the applicants. Now, we can and do redact, so we will blank out personal information, but the submission is shared with the applicant and they will be aware of that. And again, we would talk that through with victims so that they're aware of that throughout. And I suppose in making their submission that they'd know that as well.
And if you make a decision, let's just say hypothetically, I make a submission to you on the strongest possible terms that I don't believe the person who attacked me should be released, but you then decide that in the balance of everything that perhaps they are going to be released. Will you give me the reasonings behind that decision, the justification of sort of going against my wishes?
We do. If and again, it's very much guided by what the victim wants. If they want to know, we will inform them of the decision and we'll let them know of the reasoning behind that. And we will also, I suppose, if a victim had asked for particular conditions, and the most common one that we've been hearing so far has been around geography, you know, I don't want to meet them in my village. We'll also let them know as to whether or not that formed part of the parole process. We try, throughout the process, we try and work and meet with victims where they want to. So at a practical level, nobody has to come to Dublin. If we can at all, we meet them locally in their own area, if that's what people want. Some people do prefer the anonymity of coming to Dublin. More often than not, people don't. And similarly, we'll work with them, whether it's written or in person. Or I suppose that I'm very conscious that for many victims, this is the first time that they have a role in the process since the trial. And for some victims, because we're talking about particularly old cases, they may not have had any role in the trial. They may not have had the opportunity to make a victim impact statement. We want to work with them to make this as straightforward a process as possible. It's not an easy process. It's not something nice. Nobody would ever particularly want to be a victim of serious crime like this. But we don't want to make it any more difficult than it needs to be.
And I could be wrong, but presumably the way whether people like parole being offered to people who've received life sentences or not, that is the law. Presumably the perpetrator, as much as people might not wish to believe that they have, they do also have rights which have to be balanced with the way the system is set up, what is good for them, as much as the victims or the victims' families. I mean, as I say, that might be hard for people to, it might be unpalatable for some, but that is they do have rights, and that they have those rights within the system.
That's right. This is very much balancing between the applicant and the victims and their families and the community, because we're, you know, part of our role is also ensuring that there's protecting our community as well. So within that, then there are a whole pile of different rights and responsibilities, all of which need to be respected and valued within the process then.
Okay, right, that's very, it's interesting information. Parole board only considers applications from prisoners serving a life sentence. Isn't that correct?
At the moment, that those are the only people who are eligible to apply.
And at the moment also, you contact the victims, or in some cases, if they get wind that maybe a hearing is coming up, maybe a number has changed, maybe the person that was initially logged as the victim, something's happened to them. I don't know. There's many different scenarios. So you try as best as possible to contact, but if you don't...
We try our very best. We work with An Garda Síochána to both, I suppose, identify the victims and their families and also their contact details. We don't have a register of victims of serious crime in Ireland, so we don't necessarily have their contact details. So we would encourage anyone who has been a victim of serious crime, which has resulted in a life sentence, that if they want to make a submission to get in contact with us, they can go onto our website, gov.ie/paroleboard. They can email us at VLO, that's short for Victim Liaison Officer, @paroleboard.ie, or they can give us a ring at 01-474-8770. And then we can talk them through the process and they can register with us. You know, if it's early on in a life sentence, they can decide to register with us and make a decision about a submission at a later stage.
Yeah. Okay, listen, thank you very much. I really appreciate your time today. It's been interesting and informative, as we always like on this programme. Take care.
Thank you very much, Greg.
Thank you. On to the programme now, we welcome Marie. Hi, Marie. Good morning to you.
Hi, Greg. How are you?
Good, good. I'm not sure if I'm speaking to you off the back of this announcement from Eamon Ryan that we're all going to be able to borrow 30 or 40, 50,000 euro to retrofit our homes. But you've already done the heavy lifting. You've got pretty well-insulated, well-heated home.
Exactly. We have a small four-bedroom new house. It's well-insulated. It's underfloor heating and air-to-water, a 9 kilowatt heat pump. With the solar panels, the PV ones, to help cut down the electricity, and a smart meter installed as well that updates every 30 minutes. We're in the house just under 2 years now, Greg, at the new house. We're usually happy enough with the bills until the November, December bill come in, which, Greg, I was in 250 in credit. The government's 200 went in on top of that, and I thought I was well sorted at that. And I was still left with a bill of 140 to pay. Now, I had one plug-in Christmas light that went on in the evening, and the rest was all batteries. Like, and I went out for Christmas dinner, so there wasn't any extra cooking or nothing like that. And it was a four-bedroom semi-detached house, and I got a wild shock, Greg, when I saw the bill. And as I thought I was well sorted for the next bill, I didn't even think I had to worry about this one. Not even talk about the next one. Like, I don't know if this is much or not, but I use 1,522 kilowatts on that bill. So I don't know if that's a high one or a low one.
Well, you're asking the wrong person here. But am I correct in saying then that your bill for that couple of months was 590?
Yeah, exactly. 590. Spot on.
Wowzers.
I got that's crazy.
Yeah, and do you know what your smart meter is telling you your usage is since the last bill?
Actually, that's so weird because in the app that I have, it says fugue usage report, and I can't actually get down to the bottom of the screen to press it. It's so maddening because I can't see it until I get a surprise. Until the bill comes in. So I'm not exactly sure how to do that.
What are you attributing this to? Did you finish a year with the same company? Like maybe you've switched rates onto a higher rate?
I did switch as well, yeah. I was, can I mention company?
Yeah, go ahead, yeah.
can I mention, I was with Electric Ireland and then I did swap with them. I was with them for the first year and then I swapped over then to SSE and I'm with them currently.
Right. So you know your 1,000 watts or whatever the unit is that you used over those 2 months?
Do you
know what your usage was in the previous 2 months? So in other words, is it excess usage or has the cost gone up, I wonder?
I was trying to look that up. I don't actually know. Yeah. I must have a look for that as well and actually look at that aspect as well because I haven't thought of actually looking.
Well, it was either one light. We know it wasn't because you cooked the turkey.
Yeah.
But no. You're doing everything here. You've got the heat pump, although those electric pumps can be rather expensive. But you've got the solar panels. You've got a really well insulated, very easily heated home. I imagine almost 600 quid for 2 months is massive.
Was
it 3 months?
No, 2 months. I got a wild shock, Greg, to see that bill. I thought I was well sorted for this month. And going on to the next month, I was nearly sorted. I wasn't. Because previous, my other bills was, say, about two.
Right, okay, Marie, I think we've lost you there, but we've got the thrust of what you were saying. Thank you. That was Marie there. So, small four-bedroom new house, well-insulated, underfloor heating, air-to-water heat pump, solar panels, smart meter in, and just got the bill for November, December, €590. Okay, does that resonate with any of you? What's going on there, I wonder? I think Marie's definitely going to have to look at in case there's something drawing power that she wasn't aware of. Maybe the unit price has gone up. Maybe that's... Is 1,000 odd kilowatts usage, is that high? People out there that keep a really close eye on these things, maybe you're able to help us. But that's a big bill, isn't it? Right, a caller says that if someone gets life, they should get life. Coming from experience, having had to deal with a family member being killed with the perpetrator getting out after a very short time, they should do the time that is handed down to them for the crime. Another, how does the parole board feel when a culprit is released and then goes on to reoffend, for instance, rape? I presume that is part of the risk, isn't it? Agree with Greg. The growing anger and disrespect towards Gardaí stems from decades of a two-tier justice system in this country where a privileged class from the political establishment and the church were treated differently from others in society. Going by recent events, nothing has changed. I'm not sure if I quite said that, but if that's what was picked up. Greg, there are three security on days in Sligo while there are three on nights. While there are only one security on days in Letterkenny Hospital and two on nights, it's too big of a campus to look after during the day and night. Security should be beefed up in Letterkenny before we have a serious issue like Cork Mercy Hospital. Now, I am not doubting what you're saying for a second, but I hope you also understand that we've contacted the HSE just to get those figures, because I think, you know, it is well worthwhile finding that information out. I too totally agree that parochial protests have no effect. It has to take place in Dublin. Remember when medical cards were being taken from the elderly? Remember the anti-water charge protest? Dublin is the only place to let the government know that Donegal's not part of the six counties. I seem to remember a huge protest through the streets of Letterkenny, though, over the water charges. That was very impactful. I suppose you say, right, well, let's go to Dublin. It's hard to get lots and lots of people to Dublin. They have to be really motivated. But you may well be right. Guards need guns, believes a caller. I'm not sure many would agree with that. Maybe they would. The security of the state, he says, yet they're letting refugees into our country who say they have lost passports on the plane. Who have we protecting us at all? I think it's very important for all of us who think for ourselves and not just to follow blindly what others say and believe it to be absolutely true. There are 12,000 refugees who aren't Ukrainian refugees in the country at the moment. A small proportion of those did that, ripping the passports up on the plane, or are suspected of doing so. But we are taking, I mean, I think a million of these refugees went into Germany, and you could talk about the size of our country and all that kind of stuff, but there's 12,000. The government themselves are talking about cracking down on people coming in without paperwork. I see what you're saying, but we've got problems here that are ours, in inverted commas. You know, we're not necessarily importing them in. So I think that's a bit of conflation here. In other words, to say, well, it can't be us. Nothing that we do could be wrong. It must be these people that are coming here. Well, that's not the truth, because, you know, there's been a lot of crime here and it's been getting worse for quite some time. What about all the 999 calls that were cancelled during COVID? Maybe people didn't like this. Greg, anyone assaulting a member of the Garda Síochána, a state employee, should spend at least 6 months in prison, believes Mary. How about mandatory sentences for guards who assault the public? Guards don't be charged straight away. There does be a long investigation, they say. Fair play to Mary T, a local girl caring about her local hospital service time. Her local hospital service. It's time the local representatives got their fingers out and back her. The management of the hospital is not working. Time it was rooted out and new management brought in to run the hospital right. I mean, in fairness, though, say, for instance, I on this programme have spoken to members of all political parties, government parties, opposition parties, then individuals like Mary T speaking in her own capacity there. And they're all of the same opinion that something really needs to be done. Me and my friends got a taxi on Saturday evening. I did have cash on me, but preferred to hold on to it in case we got stuck later in the night. When I asked the driver if he took card, he responded with, "What do you think this is? A hole in the wall? Aren't they legally obliged to take the cards now?" Not quite sure if that's come into effect, because I don't be in taxis very often. When I was in taxis more often than I am now, no one took card. I can think of one or two in my local area that do. I'm not sure about the rest. I'm not sure also if it's fully enforced yet that they must be able to take the card. I don't know. I don't want to comment because it would be misleading. Hello, Greg. Could you please highlight the road on the Glenties side of Fintown? There are two hills in a valley with a bridge, and it's in need of major repairs. This 20-plus years, there were bad accidents at this point in the past, and for years there is plastic barriers acting as protection from the river. How many times have council workers and councillors and TDs passed this for years and won't bother getting money to get it repaired? Thanks, Greg. Is this the same bridge where travelling into Letterkenny come down a steep brae, there's a couple of bends, you have the bridge and then you sort of turn right and up and around? Is that the same bridge we're talking of? It's an important road. It has a lot of traffic. It certainly would need protection to ensure no one goes into the river off that bridge. Because of the system's failure, he cannot put them in. Do you want him to come in and read them out? this is why the bingo numbers. This is why the bingo. I thought it was a comment. This is why the bingo numbers weren't played, because they couldn't go into the computer. And Caroline says, because of a systems failure, which is quite a dramatic way of saying we couldn't transfer the file. Do you want him to come in and read them out, or do you want to do it yourself? Keep those texts coming in. 086 60 25,000. Right. Okay. well, you got the bingo numbers anyway, and it's we'll get that file in correctly for you tomorrow. It was just the computer playing up for us. It's no individual's fault. All right, 086 60 25,000, WhatsApps and texts, or give us a call. And see, I read everything out, even complaints from Caroline. They got read out. Listen, we had a huge response to our programme at the end of last week. A lot of people saying the same thing. People with defective concrete affected homes, incredibly frustrated. Incredibly frustrated and believing that people of Donegal are being treated different to Dublin. Like, I have dozens and dozens and dozens of them. As much as I tried in speaking to Minister Charlie McConnell, who's a lightning rod for all of this, right? I accept that. Okay. I also accept that this is and I hope everyone accepts that this is an incredibly, incredibly big issue in this part of the world. And it's very, very, very emotive. And it's very hard to make a counterpoint to the fact that the people of Donegal feel that they should be treated the same as the people of Dublin. I do as best as I can trying to be balanced. This is a problem that it's the government have created themselves, in that they agreed this scheme for the people of Donegal, and then they've agreed another scheme for the people of Dublin primarily. One's 100%, the other isn't. And there's thousands of people across this county that feel very upset about it. And I'm sure government representatives feel upset that maybe they are the lightning rod for all of this anger. But of course, it is they ultimately that make these decisions. And with big jobs and big decisions, there's going to be quite a lot of public discourse, those that agree with you and those that don't. It's very hard to strike a balance on why people of Donegal are treated differently to the people of Dublin, as much as I would try to. But anyway, lots and lots of you very, very upset, suffice to say. Ger Deering is the Ombudsman. He joins us on the programme now. Good morning to you, Ger.
Good morning, Greg.
Great to have you on the programme. Right, you are currently a year into your new role as Ombudsman for Public. You took over from Peter Tindall, who's a regular guest on this programme. So, for those new to it, what is the role of the Ombudsman? Because there's different ombudsmen, right? You're singular.
That's correct.
Are you sort of an umbrella of all ombuds people, or what's the story?
No, we wouldn't be an umbrella of all ombuds people, but actually our role is to deal with all public services, Greg. So if anybody has a difficulty or a complaint with any public service, and also nursing homes are included as a public service because they receive public funding, what they should do is first make a complaint to the service provider themselves, whether that's the local authority or a hospital or whatever. And if they're not satisfied with the response that they receive from that organisation, then they can bring a complaint to us here at the Ombudsman Service. And we'll firstly try to resolve the complaint in an informal way as quickly as we possibly can. But if that doesn't work, we will actually carry out an investigation into the complaint and issue a recommendation.
Do you have to exhaust all of the pathways for recourse locally, let me put it like that, before you can then go on and make a complaint to the Ombudsman?
Yes, it's important, Greg, that the body concerned has the opportunity to resolve the complaint. And I'm happy to say that very often they do. Very often when the person actually complains to the body concerned, they will respond and react and put things right. So it's really only if the body themselves doesn't do that the person should come to us.
Some of the things that come up here, for example, you know, the cross-border treatment purchase, it's not the treatment purchase fund, sorry, I'm conflating, the cross-border scheme whereby someone can go into the north, for example, get some treatment, and then they come back to the Republic, and next thing you know, the HSE says, well, we can only give you such and such because, you know, there's lots of different reasons the HSE might give give that, but they believe they've done all the correct paperwork, they got the right code for the right operation, they've gone into the credit union or whatever to buy the money, and then they're left with this huge bill. Is that a matter for the Ombudsman, and how might one make a representation to your offices on an average case like that?
Yep, that very definitely is a very good example of what we deal with, Greg. And in fact, at the moment, and I'll talk a little bit more about this maybe in a minute, we're undertaking a systemic investigation into the schemes. There are a number of schemes, and they're in some respects quite complicated, but at the heart of these schemes is exactly what you've said. If somebody can't get treatment here because the waiting list is too long, or that they just need the treatment urgently, there are a number of schemes whereby they can travel to another jurisdiction. And the one you mentioned there, there was the cross-border scheme which operated between, in fact it operates at the directive within the EU, but of course when the UK left under Brexit, left the EU, that created a certain problem, and an interim scheme has been put in place, the Northern Ireland Planned Healthcare Scheme. So it operates very much as the previous schemes used to. But we've discovered a significant number of complaints about how these schemes actually operate. And for example, you have to have a consultation in relation to the treatment before the actual treatment itself takes place. You also have to have a referral from a doctor or a specialist in this jurisdiction before you go. And we've seen situations where, for example, the letter from the consultant mightn't have been dated, or the letter from the GP might have been PP'd by their secretary, or might not have been addressed to the correct consultant. And these are problems that should be overcome. Where this happens, the HSE should be going back to the people concerned and giving them an opportunity to fix them. But in some instances, we've actually seen, exactly as you've outlined, that the repayment has been denied to the person. And some of these people, they borrow the money from the credit union. You know, they're already in a very stressful situation because they need this treatment. And then to go and borrow money maybe from a credit union or a relative, have the treatment undertaken and find that you don't get the repayment can be very stressful. So,
and you've had success in this regard. I understand there was one local case where a woman was reimbursed. Is that correct?
That's correct. We've had a number of cases where we've interacted with the HSE and they've re-examined the cases. But because the scheme is so important and because the distress that can be caused can be so significant, I've decided to undertake a specific investigation into this area. Mm-hmm. And we're at an advanced stage of that investigation. And I might just explain, Greg, that it's not just when complainants come to us. I can also instigate an investigation into a scheme or into conduct where I identify that maybe there's a wider problem and that we could solve it at a wider level. And I must give credit to the HSE. We've done reports in areas with the HSE in the past, and they've responded very well to the recommendations, and they've improved their systems and their complaint system. And I'm very hopeful that when we present the findings of this particular investigation, that it will improve how these schemes are operated, and most especially it will improve life for people who are seeking treatment in other jurisdictions.